I'm Bob Brown, and this is an informal session to talk about some of the writings of Elie Wiesel. Let me just begin to ask for how many of you have never heard of Elie Wiesel before? That's quite legitimate to say that. That's very helpful to me. How many have read at least one of his works? Good. Well, I hope particularly those of you that have done some reading will offer your own observations during the course of the time. This is in some sense a difficult assignment for me because I have been very much immersed in the writings of Elie Wiesel and the privilege of a friendship with him for 8 or 10 years now. He's been an extraordinarily important influence on me, which is a little unusual when you consider that a Protestant theologian should probably be spending more time with Luther, to pick a name at random, or Calvin or Augustine or many of the others. I've been through a lot of that in my training, and I've gone through quite a theological revolution through the contacts of the last 10 years, first of all with a Roman Catholic priest from Latin America named Gustavo Gutierrez, and also almost at the same time with a Jewish novelist, Elie Wiesel. Reference was made to the fact that I had done a book about him. I comment on that only to say that I think there's a neat ecumenical symbolism in that. It's a book about a Jew by a Protestant published by a Roman Catholic University Press, University of Notre Dame. And it's interesting that there has been a great deal of Christian interest in Wiesel. He said that maybe, he figures maybe 60% of his readership is Christian. So he is clearly speaking not just to the Jewish community, but to Christians, and as I would want to maintain, to all people, to all humanity. Now, I think the best thing I can do to try to use the economy of time will be to say a few things about some themes in at least some of his writings to give a little bit of common material that then we can all share, and then have as much time as possible for you to ask questions or make comments or push the discussion any way that you want. And what I propose is, as rapidly as I can, to say a few things about his own personal pilgrimage and journey. Because although it is a journey that probably none of us have even come close to going through, it's almost a kind of very vivid and very painful and italicized account of what has happened to millions and millions of people in our world and is in many ways being recapitulated in the lives of many people today, whether they're Jews or not. And I propose to raise the question, which certainly haunts him through his whole life: how do we respond to monstrous evil? That's a question he had to face because he was a young, very pious, Hasidic Jewish boy in Middle Europe, in Hungary, at the time that World War II began, and as you know, Hitler engaged in what was called the final solution, namely the attempt to obliterate, to destroy every member of the Jewish race. And he came painfully close to doing that, destroying 6 million Jews in Europe, whose only crime was that, as has been said, they had their own grandparents. To have not even that, to have one grandparent who was Jewish made you a candidate for the crematoria. You didn't have to have any political opinion. You could even be a small child, a baby. If you were Jewish, as defined by one Jewish grandparent, then that was a crime that was worthy of your death and extinction. Wiesel was 14 years old when the Germans came into the little town of Szeged in Hungary, in which he had grown up, and he was taken off with everybody in that town to Auschwitz. He survived, I would say almost in quotation marks, he survived Auschwitz physically, although the psychic scars were deep and remain, and he took an oath at the age of 15 that he would not write a word about this for 10 years. He would let this sink into him and make sure that when he tried to tell his story to the world, it would be told without distortion and with as much clarity as possible. And he wrote a kind of very short autobiography which had the title of Night. All the other books I've listed here in order of their writing, the novels which he wrote after Night. And if you ever have an interest in reading Wiesel at first hand, I would strongly urge you to read them in the order of their composition. That's the only way you can even at a minimal distance share in his own journey. And I would warn you in advance, as we'll see in a moment, that for quite a while that journey is nothing but a series of downers. I've taught courses on Wiesel's novels to university students and seminary students for 7 or 8 years now, and the atmosphere in the class for the first month gets worse and worse. We read one novel each week, and I maintain that one has to go through the experience of his utter despair before one is entitled to begin to appropriate with him the affirmations that do begin to emerge. The affirmations he can begin to make have been bought at a very heavy price, and therefore can be taken as very fine credentialed affirmations. Nothing is cheap, and nothing is ever wiped away as though somehow the good that comes out of evil makes the evil all right. No cheapness there at all. Now let me just very quickly indicate a few of the things that emerge in these novels. So I said, I think his question is, how do we respond to monstrous evil, which certainly the Holocaust quintessentially represents in our time and maybe in any time in human history? Night seems to me the story of the response which one does not have the privilege of choosing. It is a response which is made for one on behalf of someone else, namely that you respond to monstrous evil as victim. You don't choose to be a victim. That role is chosen for you by others. But Night is the story of the victim. And I just give you one picture or two from there to indicate where Elie Wiesel comes from. All the way from Szeged to Birkenau, which was the death camp for Auschwitz, where they first went in the sealed cattle cars, none of them really believed the stories they'd heard. They could not believe that Germany, which had produced Goethe and Schiller and Beethoven and Goethe and great culture, could be doing the things that the reports were saying, gassing Jews, machine gunning them down, destroying children and so forth. And they entered Birkenau at night and got out of the railroad car. Wiesel, the 14-year-old boy, tells about seeing a big bonfire by the station and seeing a dump truck come up and dump out its load. And Wiesel looked, he says, they were babies. And he says, never will I forget that night. Never will I forget the night which destroyed my faith and my soul forever. Never will I forget that night, even though I should be doomed to live as long as God himself. And in that one evening, his faith was destroyed. His mother and sister went off into the other camp and were never heard from again. Presumably they might even have been sent to the chambers that very night. They did not survive. He and his father were sent in the other direction, and he then tells in very stark understatement what it was like to be in Auschwitz for that period, and for a while in Buna, another satellite camp of Auschwitz. In the course of this, his father got more and more feeble, and finally Wiesel saw his father bludgeoned to death by one of the guards before his very eyes. And with a piercing kind of honesty, he writes, having known that his father was becoming more and more of a liability to his own survival as he tried to take care of his father, he says, "My first reaction was free at last, and my second reaction was one of unending and eternal shame that I should have had that thought." As the war came to an end, he and the others in the camps were marched westward to escape or marched away from the camps to escape the oncoming Allied forces, and he ended in Buchenwald, and finally that camp was liberated. And again, with stark honesty, he said, "Our first thought was for food, and we ate and gorged ourselves. Wiesel got stomach poisoning, almost died, was in the hospital for 3 weeks." And at the very end of the book, he describes getting out of the hospital bed because there was a mirror on the wall. He said, "I had not seen myself in a mirror since my days back in the ghetto." And he ends with the words, "I looked into the mirror and a corpse looked back at me." This is where the 14-year-old boy comes from, and where all of his subsequent life has had to try to deal with what those events represented. Almost by pure happenstance, he and other young refugees after the war ended up in France. He got some education there. He learned French. He went to the Sorbonne, and he began, after the 10 years, to turn out in quite rapid succession this stream of four further novels, in which now, in fictional form, he deals with this problem of living as a Jew in a post-Holocaust world and having to confront that monstrous evil. How does one deal with it? The option of victim, which Knight had explored, is obviously not an attractive option. Albert Camus had written an essay at this time about the options of being victim or executioner. And in Dawn, Wiesel explores the option of being executioner. If evil is so monstrous, it might be better at least to be the executioner rather than the victim. And he tests that out in a very small, a short story about a young post-Holocaust Jew in Paris, very much like Wiesel himself, who has the name of Alicia, who is approached by a member of the Jewish guerrilla forces in Palestine, which at that point is seeking to get freed up from Britain's presence so the State of Israel can be established. And young Alicia is enlisted to go back and fight with the guerrilla forces to beat the British. And he tells about learning methods of commando tactics, how to use a knife and a gun, how to strangle in total silence, and becomes an executioner. Some of those things he's able to deal with, but there comes a point at which the British have captured David Ben Moshe, a member of the guerrilla forces, and say they're going to execute him the next dawn as a lesson to the Jews to stop trying to upset the British rule. The Jewish guerrilla forces respond by capturing John Dawson, a British soldier, whom they say they will execute in reprisal if David Ben Moshe is executed. No way either side can back down. And the guerrilla forces have to choose someone to execute John Dawson, to shoot him, and young Elisha has that task put upon him. As he goes down into the basement to do this act when dawn comes, he says he could feel on his arm the swastika of the SS troops. Somehow he was becoming that which he had for so long abhorred. And there is an hour or two before dawn, and Elisha and John Dawson talk. Elisha wants desperately to be able to hate John Dawson. If only he can hate him, it will be easier maybe to kill him as a representation of all those things he detests. But he can't do it. in any other circumstances, they would probably have been good friends. But the dawn, the moment of dawn comes, and he has to raise the pistol and shoot John Dawson in cold blood. The next lines are, "That's it," I thought, "I've killed. I've killed." And then it doesn't say, he doesn't say, "I've killed John Dawson." He says, "I've killed Elisha." And he realizes that murder is really another form of suicide. That in killing this other person, he has killed, he has destroyed something very essential in himself. So if the role of victim is not a way to deal with monstrous evil, neither is the role of executioner. What other roles might there be? In the next book, which is called in English The Accident, but in French was called Le Jour, you see he had a sequence, La Nuit, l'Aube, Le Jour, night, dawn, day, but in English, for whatever reasons, they called it The Accident, which does, in a sense, describe what happens in the book. Because now the young Holocaust survivor, now named Eliezer, is a newspaper correspondent in New York. And as he's going across Times Square, he's run over by a taxi and taken to the hospital. And the book is a series of flashbacks about this person who also had been a victim in the camps, the same kind of story. And the problem here, as for all of them, was this monstrous evil which is eating me, which is gnawing me, which is destroying me, and it is this past from which I cannot escape. I cannot escape from the memories of it. It has seared me. It has destroyed me. I cannot really relate to other people because in the image that Eliezer uses, the filth which I now have gone through and represent in relationship to other people, I only dump that on them. And so he cannot deal with that past. He cannot enter into a significant relationship with another human being. There is a woman, Kathleen, who loves him, but he cannot truly love her in return. He cannot enter into relationship. The past has this absolute grip upon him. While he's in the hospital, an old friend, Gyula, from Hungary, who's a portrait painter, comes into the hospital to see him every day and paints his portrait. And when it is completed, Gyula turns the canvas around so Eliezer can see it. And he looks into the eyes of the portrait. And he knows that Gyula knows that he, Eliezer, was involved in what can only be called an accident in the most technical sense. Because Eliezer, when he was crossing Times Square, saw the taxi coming and willed not to step out of the way. In other words, he tried suicide as a way of escaping from this burden of the past and the monstrous nature of the evil. And that didn't work either. Now, that was only the most extreme attempt by Eliezer in this book. I would call this book the attempt to solve the problem by flight. We try to get away from it. Avoid people. Don't enter into relationship. Get yourself killed if you can. Gyula had said in what seems like a very hopeful passage, "Look, stamp out the past. Forget it. Put it behind you. Live in the presence. Love. Love Kathleen. She needs your love. You need hers." And it sounds like a prescription for a new beginning. But when Gyula leaves the room, after that prescription and the burning of the portrait, which is, you see, a symbolic destruction of Eliezer's past, Wiesel pens what maybe to that point are the most tragic lines. He says, "Gyula had forgotten to remove the ashes." There's no way fully to get rid of the past. The ashes remain. And what more significant and searing symbol for survivors of Auschwitz and Dachau than ashes, because that's where everybody else had ended up. So that doesn't work either. It's not until the fourth book, The Town Beyond the Wall, that there begin to be some breakthroughs. But before we, the readers, are privileged to begin to see that direction, we have to go through with the protagonist two other attempts to deal with the presence of monstrous evil that don't work. This time, the protagonist is called Mikhail. And there are a couple of things that emerge in the first part of his story. One is the option to go mad, seriously entertained. And the flyleaf, Wiesel has the inscription from Dostoevsky's The Idiot. I have a plan to go mad. This means simply real clinical madness. You simply decide you won't live in the real world anymore. And as you know, we have hospitals full of these people who can't cope with reality and make a decision to opt out. And in the book, there is such a person who is encountered by Mikhail in the prison cell, refers to him as the silent one. He has totally cut himself off. There is no response from him. He is living, walking around, engaging in his bodily functions, but nothing else. There is no response at all. And this is a great temptation to Mikhail, who has had the same story as all the other characters we've been looking at. And he comes very, very close indeed to it. And he realizes that to go mad, to leave totally this world of reality, that's a one-way road. The door into madness has a handle only on the outside. Once you get in there, there's no way you can escape back into the world of reality. And that option is explored. But the other option for dealing with monstrous evil that does not work is the most devastating of all to Wiesel. And that, for him, it is the most devastating of all, is in many ways, for me, almost the most devastating thing to confront. Because it is the option which I and most of us, I think, are most likely to entertain in the presence of evil that seems out of control or beyond anything we can do. Mm-hmm. Mikhail, in this story, like Eliezer in the accident, can't deal with his past, but he says, I've got to go back to where the thing started and confront the problem there. And so he makes arrangements to get back into the town of his birth. This is like Wiesel's birth in Eastern Europe. It's now behind the Iron Curtain. He goes back to the place of his birth. He doesn't know why he needs to go back there, but he figures somehow the answer to his problem must be located there. And as he's walking around the town square, from which he and his sister and family had been evacuated by the Germans 2 or 3 years earlier, reliving that experience, suddenly something clicks. He remembers that at that time of the deportation by the Nazis, he had looked up in one of the windows in the apartment surrounding the square and had seen there a face in the window, absolutely impassive, no engagement, no emotion, whatever. Somebody who is simply and utterly a spectator to the evil thing that was happening down below. Someone who refused to take sides, who disengaged from that event. And Mikhail realizes that is why he had come back to Serencevaros, to discover how someone who is human could act in that subhuman way. He goes to that apartment and the man is still there. And they have a devastating conversation. And the spectator remembers the incident. He says, yes, I felt nothing. Neither way, neither for you or for the Nazis. And he says finally, I expect you hate me. And Mikhail says, no, I don't hate you. Hatred is something we reserve for human beings. For you, I can feel only contempt. For what you are is less than human. He reflects the victim, the executioner. Yes, we can understand even something about the executioner. Victims and executioners are at least in some kind of relationship to one another. What characterizes the spectator is total lack of relationship. And he struggles with that. How can one see those things and remain disengaged? How can one be so disengaged and claim to love children or family or to pray to God? And it is this role of spectator in the face of monstrous evil that Wiesel thinks is the most culpable role of all, even worse than the executioner, because the spectator lets somebody else do all the dirty work for him. The spectator is consenting unto whatever evil is done. And that is, for Wiesel, an abdication of being a fully human person. So there is this devastating picture of the spectator. Wiesel wrote one or other book. His first version of Night was in Yiddish. It was a much longer version, and the title of that first book was And the World Remained Silent. And he takes in the writings this theme of spectator, epitomized by this man in the window, says that is the role that the civilized world played in relation to the rise of Hitler to power. All were silent, with a few tiny minimal exceptions. All were silent. All were spectators. None wanted to get engaged. Everybody says, we'll look away and maybe it won't happen. Or some people said, we don't really like the Jews. Thank God the Nazis are going to take care of the Jews for us, so we won't have to do it. But we'll get the privilege of living in a world without Jews. So this role of spectator remains, and certainly to haunt me, as the role to which I am always tempted, which we are always tempted to. Let somebody else worry about Nicaragua or El Salvador or world hunger or what's happening in our own town to blacks or whatever. A pretty discouraging journey. But it is only toward the end of this book that the turning point begins to come. And let me say just a little bit about that. It is, I think, in terms of the need to find what is the obverse of spectator. If that is the worst response, what is the human role which would begin to signify something like a creative response? And I don't, there's not a single word which sort of epitomizes this. The word I've kind of settled on, at least to point toward that role, is the word participant. The way in which one begins to deal in these less than totally destructive ways with dealing with monstrous evil is to participate in sharing in the plight of the victims, to place oneself not way off away and out of reach, but to say there is no possibility of being truly a spectator. That is, the spectator is always on the side of the forces that have the most power. The spectator is really taking sides by default. So one must choose the other side, rather than by default ending up with the executioners. One must try to align oneself with the victims, and maybe if there are enough people doing that, the executioners will cease to be able to do what they're about. But if not, nevertheless still, to die with victims rather than to live as the one who is the executioner. And this breakthrough, this notion of sharing in the situation of the other, sharing in the plight of the victim, happens in this prison cell where Mikhail, having gone back to Serencevaros, and having been tricked by the spectator who turns him in to the secret police, thereby stopping being a spectator, you see, but becoming part of the executionary process as a result, Mikhail is thrown into the jail, and here is the silent one, the one who has gone mad, totally out of touch. And Mikhail, what is he going to do in that situation? Now, just let me say a little bit about that and then open this up for discussion, because I don't want to preempt too much time just with this exposition. The thing that had gotten Mikhail back to his hometown was help from Pedro, whom he had met earlier on, and the relationship with Pedro was the first relationship that Mikhail had ever dared engage in since he got out of the camps. He had 6 million reasons not to trust any human beings. The ability to trust another was for him and most of the survivors almost impossible. Their trust had been so totally betrayed. And in the story, Mikhail resists relationship with a number of characters along the way. One of them, a woman with whom one almost feels it's now going to be possible that he can love. But he shuts that door in terror at what it would mean to be vulnerable to a relationship in love. But finally, with Pedro, there is the beginning of a breakthrough. They meet, they talk, they spend a whole night walking around Algiers talking, and they do that for several nights going, and a relationship of mutuality and sharing begins to be built up, something totally new for him. And Pedro becomes a kind of foreshadowing of a sort of redemption for Mikhail. When they leave at the end of the week, Pedro says to him as they depart, "I will never forget these days. From now on, when somebody asks me, Pedro, what my name is, I will say, I am Mikhail. And when somebody asks you your name, you can say, I am Pedro." They've discovered that one is not a human being just in solitariness or isolation. One is a human being only in relation to another. And that's the beginning of the breakthrough. And so when Mikhail is in the prison cell, this relationship with Pedro comes back to help him. And he engages in imaginary conversations with Pedro. And he tells Pedro, "Look, I'm stuck here with this cretin, this guy that I can't even communicate with at all. I'm going out of my mind." And Pedro says in the imaginary conversation, "Mikhail, you'll have to recreate this universe." And speaking about the silent one, Pedro says to Mikhail, and in 5 words, the whole secret of what is happening, I think, is expressed. Pedro says to him, "Cure him, he'll save you." You've got to invest yourself totally in that other person. And as you do so, out of that relationship will come your own healing. Because Mikhail realizes if he is in that prison cell much longer in total isolation, he'll go mad too, whether he wants to or not. Cannot be a full person in total isolation. And so at the end of the book, he is reaching out in all kinds of ways to try to draw the silent one out of the total wall of isolation he has built around himself, from which the silent one cannot extricate himself. But Pedro, through all kinds of devices, finally begins to break through that facade of total denial of the real world around him. And the breakthroughs begin, and the little responses begin. There he does such a thing as depriving him of his food when it comes in, and you'll offer it to him and then pull it back out of love. And finally, after several days, there's the slightest little bit of response, almost a whimper. And for Mikhail, that is the most joyful day of his life. There's beginning to be response, and that begins to build up. And finally, toward the end, he says to the silent one, "Sometime, my friend, you may be in another prison cell, and somebody will ask you your name, and you will say, I am Mikhail, and then you will taste the greatest of victories." It is in this relationship, in the sense of investment in the situation of another person, that healing begins to take place. Now let me almost stop at that point. That is by no means the end of the story. In Gates of the Forest, Gates of the Forest, the sense of relationship is extended to community. The move is from the forest to the city. You can't stay off in the solitude of the forest alone, and no matter how nice it is. You've got to go into this. It's Brooklyn. I mean, if you want a symbol of of a city that's rough and tough and so forth, only in the communal reality is this sense of selfhood more fully enhanced. And at the end of this book, he is back with the Hasidic group in Brooklyn, and they're saying the Kaddish, the prayer for the dead, which is basically a prayer in which, as Wiesel says, we return to God, God's throne and scepter. We acknowledge God's reality. So the relationship between two persons becomes, for Wiesel, the place where God is found. God is in the midst of the situation where there is relationship, and the human relationship becomes the pointer for him to the divine relationship. So he makes his way back by this painful route, book after book, year after year, to the place where he can now affirm the impingement and the reality of God in what goes on between human beings. That never becomes an easy, cheap answer. It's always a struggle. And for Wiesel, it's always a God whom one has to ask questions of and challenge. Wiesel is not satisfied with answers to questions like, why did God let the Holocaust happen? Or where was God when the Jews were going into the ovens? There's no way to answer those questions. He says we have to challenge God. We have to take to challenge God, to ask God questions, to quarrel with God. That's really to take God seriously. So Job is one model that in the biblical story Wiesel turns to again and again. I think myself Jeremiah is the better one. Jeremiah keeps fighting God all his life. In effect, he's saying, Yahweh, get off my back. Leave me alone. Why do the wicked prosper? Why do the good always get on the neck? He struggles that way all of his life. And it's reminiscent of what Mikhail and Pedro say on one of those nights when they're walking around just beginning to establish the relationship. And they're talking about God and where has God been. And Mikhail says, I cry out against God. I blaspheme against God, but my very blasphemy is a form of prayer. It's an acknowledgement that God is there and that I have to take account of God. See, so for Wiesel, atheism is too simple and easy faith is also too simple. It says, we can handle believing in God if we don't have to bother with the world. We can handle this as a tough, rough world and we just got to make the best of it if we don't have to deal with God. Either one of these, okay, easy belief or atheism. Those are too simple, he says. The problem is we're stuck with God and the world. And there's no way we can authentically, totally deny either one. And that makes many problems. That's what we have to wrestle with, that we are in this world which seems at so many places to deny the reality of God, and yet we cannot get away from God. Our very screams and shouts and protests are somehow an acknowledgement of God, of God's reality. So the issue of God is never something he gets away from, but he does not ever come to a cheap position where he says, now finally it's all put back together again. After the trial of Eichmann in Jerusalem, which Wiesel covered as a correspondent, remember Eichmann was the German sort of functionary that carried out all the details of the final solution. It was personally responsible for the train schedules, all the kind of things that got the Jews finally into the crematoria. And they finally captured Eichmann and brought him to trial. And in a rather crude sense, a little bit of justice, many people felt, was done. And so after the trial, somebody asked one of the judges, now do you understand the Holocaust better? He responded, Wiesel reports, understand the Holocaust? I hope I never understand the Holocaust. To understand it would be worse than not to understand it. That is to say, if we could work out a scheme, if we could work out a universe in which the Holocaust fit, in which it somehow made some kind of sense, that would be a universe monstrous beyond any calculation. That would involve a kind of God who would be some kind of moral monster. So the problems will remain. Wiesel talks about the agony of the believer. He was on a platform once with Richard Rubinstein, who some of you may know was a Jew for whom Auschwitz destroyed his faith. He says, you can't believe in God after Auschwitz. And Rubinstein said in the address preceding Wiesel on the program, it's so painful to have to live in the world and not be able to believe in God. Wiesel came up afterwards and put aside his prepared talk and spoke right back to Rubinstein. And the gist of what he said, Dick, let me tell you something that is more painful than living in the world without God. That's living in the world with God. The real agony is the agony of the believer. Now, I think that's, again, still a rather somber note on which to end. The point is that the belief in God doesn't solve the problems. In some way, it makes the problems worse. But for Wiesel, that engagement with the God who cannot be put aside, who cannot be obliterated, who's on the scene, the engagement of that God is somehow what makes the human venture what it is. And to pretend that we won't have anything to do with that God, just that's too easy. We have to live in the midst of this struggle. And how do we live with it? How do we do something creative with it? We tell again and again the story of what happened to our people, not to dump guilt on everybody else, but so that it won't happen again. Let us take this event of our history and tell it and retell it so that never again will it be possible for people to do those things to anybody. Not just not to Jews, but not to anybody. And let me close with this one little episode from his later novel, The Oath. This is a story of a pogrom in Europe in the 20s, you know, when the Christians decide that they don't like the Jews around, and so they just move in and wipe them out. And one survivor of the pogrom tells about what happened. They went to the Jewish quarter, the Christians, and they slaughtered all the Jews, and they set their houses on fire. They were going so much, they just got this momentum going, and they couldn't stop it. And pretty soon they were fighting each other, brother against brother, and here was a house with a lot of people in it, and they put it on fire, more Jews to the flames, but it's all inhabited by Christians. They destroy each other. And the narrator says, I was filled with horror, and I suddenly realized that my horror was there because I was seeing the future. And Wiesel says, this can be the future. That what people have done to Jews, they begin to do to one another. And the Holocaust in the 30s and 40s was an attempt to destroy the Jews. And today, if we do not learn those lessons, we will face another Holocaust. It will be a nuclear Holocaust. And it will not just be the destruction of the Jews. It will be the destruction of everyone. The word Holocaust is from the Greek. It means the consumption by burning of all that is. And in the most precise meaning of the word Holocaust, we have the picture of what would happen if a nuclear war should break out. So Wiesel says we must hear this story from the past, not only to remember the dead and to honor them, but to look ahead to see that those now living are able to continue to live, and that we do not let the human race do now to everybody what it once did to a small portion of the human race. So he has been able to use the pain and the anguish in ways to try to set out very starkly and dramatically to the rest of us what the future looks like, and to use the past for the sake of seeing that the future is not just a replication of that past. Now, I'm sorry I've gone longer than I intended, but there are about 15 or 20 minutes left, and you want to pick up on any of these points or others, let's have some discussion. Yeah.
I have
this
question, because I can't ask them all. I just want to, you know, you were saying the progression of, I've read all of those and quite a few more, but in Town Beyond the Wall, you said the beginning of that relationship. Do you think that that is a breakthrough happens? I haven't ever gotten to discuss this with anyone. Is when he decides to go back to Clara, and he says there's a page there where it's almost like it switches, and he decides that he will continue the relationship with her.
Yeah, that's in Gates of the Forest.
Right.
Yeah.
The Gates of the Forest.
In the accident, he cannot relate to Kathleen. She wants to say, says, let love conquer the horror. And Eliezer cannot do that. At the end of Gates of the Forest, the protagonist there, Gabriel, says to Clara, let love conquer the horror. The situation is exactly reversed. And in the latter book, the protagonist is able, because some of these other things have happened, to go back into what has been a very destructive relationship with his wife, with Clara, and determine to resume that. That's a moment of great hope. We don't know what that relationship is going to be like, but that the decision has been made to return and live in that trust in that relationship. Say, the fact that it is an exact antithesis of what we had in the second book, that shows that some things have happened and some things have been learned, and that is a very positive point in the story.
When I was reading them, it just seemed like that was just, I read them in that order, that finally it seemed like something positive was going to happen. And I want you to just speak to one other thing, is it seems like, and yet, just the words, and yet, seem to be so central to Wiesel.
Yeah, there's so many themes here it hasn't been possible to touch on. I would assert that the most important words in Elie Wiesel's novels are this rather often recurring phrase, et pourtant, and yet. He describes a situation in which there is no hope left, everything has been destroyed, and yet, we must continue to create hope where there is no hope. We must continue to act in faith when there is no reason to act in faith, and so on. It is that point at which he sees that there always is something more than what all the total facts and data and logic of the situation would suggest. All the facts and data and logic of the Holocaust would suggest there is no God. If there is a God, God is a monster. And yet, we must affirm the God that we knew in the Akedah, that we knew in the Psalms, that we knew in the story of Job and so forth. We must tell that story again, so that he draws on these resources and haven't had time to deal with all the fact that after the novels he starts writing books which are the retelling of biblical stories, because they're so contemporary. And you read about Abraham and Isaac, and that's a Holocaust story going up to Mount Moriah. There's going to be a burning, you know. And what do you do about that story when they survive? And that the survivor of the Abraham, Isaac, Mount Moriah story, the survivor is named Isaac, Yitzhak. What does Yitzhak mean in Hebrew? It means laughter. So how can you describe a Holocaust survivor by the word laughter? And he for whom, as a Holocaust survivor, there had been 30 years of bitterness, that biblical story thousands of years ago says, no, the model of the survivor has got to be Isaac, the one who, in spite of everything, and yet,
He can laugh. He can affirm the world with laughter. It's an incredible kind of thing to be able to assert. Yes.
But I don't know if you're talking about one of the books in terms of the options, and when you discuss the spectator as being the least, well, almost the non-human form, and also mentioned Nicaragua and other places where there are large groups of victims. My question for you is how do we identify, or how do we reach out to that group of people, today's victims in Nicaragua, especially in a situation where you have two groups of people fighting one another regardless of other political support? Often in these situations, if you support one side, today's victim is tomorrow's oppressor. Do we just then identify with the victim as such, and through that involvement, at least we're humanized to the point that we're not standing by and watching this thing go by?
Let me take what's going to seem maybe like a cop-out on that. We're going to talk about that tonight at the forum at 9 o'clock in Nicaragua. I'm going to try to deal with that very issue. And I'd, in a sense, like to hold that question because we spend all the rest of the time. I promise not to try to avoid it, but tonight will be a more appropriate thing because I think for the few minutes, let's stick more with Wiesel questions. If there's time at the end, I'll come back to that. But it's a very good question because how do you know who are the victims and who are the executioners, or who are the oppressed and who are the oppressors and so forth? But at least I think, he says, in those situations, we have finally to take sides. And if we don't take sides, we're going to be helping whoever's got the power. We said for 40 years we didn't want to, our government supported Somoza for 40 years. If we said, oh, we don't know enough about that to have an opinion, we were also giving our support to Somoza and to the evil that represented. But if it's all right, let's hold that for the evening session right here at 9 o'clock. Yes?
It sounds to me, let's see, I hear a lot of Christian images in this, the idea of relationship being the essential to any sort of salvation in the face of evil, the theology of the cross that evil will exist and it's our reaction to it that is the most important thing in salvation of creation at all. Does he do anything with that consciously and on purpose?
Okay, I've got news for you. They're Jewish images, and we have appropriated them. I mean that very seriously. The business of the relationship coming out in town beyond the wall and so forth with the I'm Pedro and you're Mikael and so forth, that's pure Martin Buber. In fact, Wiesel had been reading Buber at that time. You can see the influence of Buber's eye now in the fictional form of this thing. I rejoice in that. In other words, our whole heritage comes out of Judaism, and we can affirm those things. We will use some different imagery. Let me give you an example. This will take just a minute or two, but I think it will speak directly to your point. Wiesel wrote a long poem called Anima Amin, which is the first words of one of Maimonides' affirmation of Anima Amin Ha Beviat Ha Mashiach. I believe in the coming of Messiah. He said that's a song he grew up with as a youth, and then he couldn't sing it anymore in the camps. You know, who could believe in the coming of Messiah anymore? And then he writes this poem, which has become a cantata. Darius Milho has set it to music. And he takes an old Midrashic tale. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs in the Midrash, they'd go down to earth and check out what was coming, come back and report to the divine throne. Here's what's happening on earth, God. You know, what are you going to do about it, and so forth. He puts that old story in the 20th century. They go down and the Holocaust is taking place. They come back and report what's happening. Silence. Nothing, no word at all. They intensify their plea. No word at all. Finally, it's so bad, the silence is so deafening, the divine throne, they get very angry at God, and so God sends the angel to give all the Job answers, you know, have faith, believe, you know, you can't understand it all, it all makes sense, something. And they reject that. And they start back, they say, no help here, all we can do is go down to earth and tell people, either God won't listen and doesn't care, or God listens but can't do anything about it.
And as they turn to go back down to earth, each one tells the story of a Jew who continued to believe in spite of, and yet he believed. A machine gun down, still will affirm God. And the narrator tells us, we are only told by the narrator, the patriarchs don't know it. The narrator says that after the first story is told, there's a tear in God's eye at this incredible faithfulness of people. After the second account of a Jew believing with no evidence for doing so, God's face is streaming with tears. After the third story, as they turn to go down to earth, the narrator says, God gets up off the throne and follows them back to earth to be in the midst of God's children. Now that's so close. I mean, we would tell that story in the imagery of the incarnation, Jesus, God manifest on earth and so forth. Wiesel is no crypto-Christian, believe me. But, you know, we need to remember in the Jewish story there is the compassion, the pity, the pain, the suffering of God, and he brings that out. There are many points at which we can make contact. Wiesel has a number of references in his writings to Jesus. And he says, Jesus is not my problem. It's what Christians have done with Jesus that is my problem. And that would be a subject for a whole other session here, because, I mean, what we have done to Jews in the name of Jesus, slaughtered them, forced conversions, the whole history of the terrible persecution of Jews inspired by Christians, you know, that's the problem, what we have done. He says at one point, I think Christians have betrayed Jesus more than Jews have. So that engagement does take place, but he will speak very powerfully of what Jesus represents and the tragedy that Jesus, who thought that by suffering on the cross he would bring redeeming love into the world, had the consequence that his followers, in the name of that cross, picked that thing up, turned it into a sword, and used the Jesus story in divisive ways to destroy the Jews. That for him is the real tragedy. He has a little picture one time where Jesus on the cross, and somebody tells him, Jesus weeps, it's too late. He realizes that the strategy isn't going to work because it will be turned around and used not for redemptive love, but for divisive hate. Now, that's pretty strong meat for Christians, but those are some of the kinds of ways in which engagement takes place. And I got to say, I think, boy, we need to hear that very much, because we really have never listened to our Christian story as it is perceived by Jews. For us, the cross is the sign of God's healing love. For the Jew, the cross is the sign of human ugliness and destructiveness. Wait a minute, let's see, anybody? Okay.
I wanted to know if you could just speak to, you know, during when you were talking, you talked about how, he talked about madness. But I understood, maybe I was misunderstanding, but I really saw two forms of madness.
Yeah, you're up, yeah.
Mad as going crazy or mad as prophet, is that correct?
Yes, I have that down here. Thank you. I just absolutely blanked on making that point. There is another kind of madness, which really is what the participant kind of represents, what Heschel calls the moral madness of the prophets, what Wiesel calls mystical madness, which is the madness of the prophet who says, you know, how it's mad to try to live in this world in terms of compassion or love. But that's the mandate that's given to believers in God, that we have to live in terms which any sensible person is going to say are crazy. At the Icon trial, he says, what really disturbed me was the ease with which the tribunal certified that Eichmann was sane. He says, if Eichmann was sane, give me madness any day. So the madness is saying, we would not be responsive to the demands of the world, of the governments who tell us to slaughter people or drop napalm or whatever, we'll respond to another voice which says a no to those things, which means in the sight of the world, we'll be looked upon as mad. But that's the madness of the prophets. That's the madness of Jeremiah. That's the madness of Amos. And that's the finally redemptive thing. I think we're going to have to stop on that note. So there is a very important kind of madness that we all need to somehow embody, even though we may not find that the term that is most congenial to us. Thank you.